always hated that noise.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Cider Voice. This is a very special episode because, as well as being joined as usual by Adam and Justin, we have an international guest. I am very delighted to be welcoming Michelle McGrath from the American Cider Association, the CEO of the American Cider Association. How are you doing, Michelle?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much. I'm excited to chat with you guys and appreciate you adjusting for the time zone thing. I know it's past dinner, almost bedtime there. Is that right?
Well, I mean, 8:30, Albert's probably taking a quick break from his harvesting and his pressing, being 24 hours a day.
And I'm taking a quick break from doing nothing at all. So,
well, actually, luckily for us, it's prime cider drinking time, but you may not be able to indulging at this time of the day.
Not quite.
But please, could you start just by, you know, although our audience is actually fairly international, most of our UK members may not have ever heard of you. So please, you just introduce yourself and your background.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, like you said, my name is Michelle McGrath, and I've been with the American Cider Association for almost 8 years. I started in 2016. Before I was with the American Cider Association, I had some roles working with nonprofits, specifically working with farmers and with advocacy. And I had a passion for value-added farmers that was launched one summer when I decided to be a cheesemonger at my local farmer's market because I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do. And it was actually there that I discovered cheese and cider go together really well, because there was a cider tent across from my cheese tent. And at the end of the market, all the vendors like trade the leftover samples. And I had Rogue Creamery cheese, which is, you know, considered one of the best cheeses in the world. So people would rush to my tent and be like, what can we trade? And I ended up going home with half drank bottles of cider. So I was like enjoying really good cheese and really good cider. And I was like, this is cool. So sort of something I discovered by accident. But I grew up on a Christmas tree farm, and I don't think I like realized how that impacted me until much later in life. But like just that direct to consumer piece, that selling something that you've grown, that, and then like that transformed into a passion for value added agriculture, like helping farmers make a living year round, was something that I was really interested in my former executive director role before I came to the American Cider Association. So I've got if you go even further back, it gets even weirder. Like I was a sea turtle biologist for a while, and it's just like it's very complicated. But the path led me to a real passion for like value-added agriculture, and the reason I'm passionate about that is because it helps farmers stay on their land, and it all comes back to land for me. So yeah, I've been at the ACA for 8 years now, and it's been really amazing. I'm the first executive director the organization's ever had. They were formed in 2013, and I was hired in 2016. And it's been really amazing to watch it grow. And one of the things that I love about the American Cider Association is, even though our mission is really focused on, you know, the United States, we do a lot of international collaborations and communications, and it's one of the things I love about my job. So I'm happy to be at the ACA. And the ACA itself, like I said, it has a mission to support the United States Association's, or the United States market. And, you know, that's what we're really focused on. But there's so many lessons that I learned from speaking to people about trends in the UK or trends in Japan or trends in Norway. Like there's always like nuggets of useful information that we can take back home. And kind of look at home. And so we do, you know, a lot of media education, and, you know, we do advocacy for cider duty, as I think that you would refer to it. But we are also doing a lot of education. So our Certified Cider Professional Program is an international program focused on trying to educate folks about cider. And our target audience for that are people outside of the industry, obviously. cider nerds love to get their certification because it certifies them as a cider nerd, which is like really cool. But we're trying to reach chefs and sommeliers and retailers and distributors and people that don't know a lot about cider and actually have to, you know, study and drink a lot of cider. So the first level is certified cider professional level one, and then second level is the certified pomelier program. And I think we're up to 81 certified pomeliers now. We just made an announcement for a big lot. So that's awesome. Education's a big, big piece of what we do.
I was just going to say, you said, obviously, you've been in kind of executive director and then CEO for 8 years. And that kind of, I know that CiderCon, which we'll get onto shortly, has been going since 2011. Am I right about
2011? Yeah. I like to say it started in a field in Oregon. It's a little bit of an exaggeration, but not that much, to be honest. Like
the 8 years that you've done that like, I mean, certainly in that time, you know, as far as my awareness of American cider goes, you know, it's just been this extraordinary revolution. It started a little before that, but it's just had this this astonishing renaissance to the point that, you know, as you said on Cider Chat with Rhea recently, you know, it really is the envy of the world in loads of respects. I mean, you know, Albert and I have certainly been kind of just looking at, you know, what's happening in kind of the American cider scene and with CiderCon and, you know, and so many of the makers over there, and just, you know, just staggering. So, I mean, I guess it'd be amazing to get some of your perspective on how things have changed in American cider in the 8 years that you've been in your role with the ACA.
Yeah. You know, they're pretty subtle changes, but they add up. So, like, Wine Enthusiast is a huge wine trade publication that targets both trade and consumers. And Wine Enthusiast was writing about cider in 2015. Now they're writing about cider a lot. So, you know, it's like these subtle things, like how often are these, how mainstreamed is the beverage? I mean, you know, there's pros and cons of being mainstream. But we know that what we call harvest-driven cider makers, those are cider makers that are pressing their fruit in season and have like a fermentation season. So like a wine model, we call them harvest-driven cider makers. So harvest-driven cider makers are getting more fine dining placements. And one of the other really interesting things that's supporting the growth of kind of those small farm-based cideries is the online presence. And I don't know that that would have happened as quickly as it did without the pandemic. So I think the pandemic really helped open a whole new channel, a whole new direct-to-consumer channel for these producers. So I think, you know, I do see, like, Wine Enthusiast wrote a whole article about, you know, exploring cider through single varietal ciders, which is just, it's kind of mind blowing, like that they would do that. So I think in general, there's more kind of conversation about the nuance of the American cider industry, and just people starting to pay attention to these messages that the ACA has certainly been repeating over and over again. Like, there's dry cider and sweet cider, there's adjunct cider and not adjunct cider, like there's 750 cider and, you know, canned cider. Like, there's a cider for everyone and every occasion and every pairing and every price point. And it used to be a broad stroke cider, you know, one bullet point. And that has now expanded into this huge conversation about all the different types of cider. And that's pretty exciting. I think it's going to open a lot of opportunities. Like, for example, there's a small cidery in California that is doing like a Michelin star pairing dinner with some Michelin star chef. And I mean, that kind of thing with cider, I mean, that's huge for us in the US. Like, it, you know, there are no cider bars, or there's a few cider bars, which there's a few in Portland that people should definitely check out when they come visit. But it's just not it's not very mainstream. And so it's a lot of like banging our head against the walls, being like, cider is really broad, cider is really diverse, cider is really nuanced. And we're having to do that less. Like people are like, oh, wait, okay. Yes, awesome. I'm starting to hear you. But I mean, the other thing, and I think there are some exceptions to this, but just from my perspective, the quality of the cider has improved vastly during that time. And that's just because people are getting more experience with their craft. I mean, that's normal for any young industry. Like people get to practice and they're learning from each other and teaching each other. They're traveling overseas and learning from folks overseas. So it's been fun to see like the quality and the experimentation and the messaging kind of all evolve. I really think that right now we're at a point where we're starting to better understand what the American, like American consumer who might be interested in apple driven ciders, what they're looking for. And I'm not the only person to have this sort of observation, but Americans are really leaning towards acid heavy, acid driven ciders. And there are some dual purpose American apples that are very acid driven that I think, like, you know, obviously American cideries are always going to enjoy playing with Kingston Black and Yarlington Mill, but I think they're also starting to be like, hey, wait a minute, this Gravenstein, this Newtown Pippin, these are cool apples too. And I'm really excited about that. I mean, I love, English cider apples, but I also love American apples. And so it's nice to see kind of, you know, like a McIntosh single varietal cider winning awards is pretty exciting for me because that's like an American apple. So I don't know. There's an interesting like acceptance of kind of the sense of place that cider offers. And I'm really thrilled to see where that goes.
Awesome. Yeah, that's awesome. I think that my impression of the American cider scene and everything you just said chimes with it is that the lessons and the trends and the changes that is happening in the UK scene mirror what you're experiencing as well. And I think it's the same in every kind of major cider region, everywhere that's starting to produce more cider, is that it falls into the whole food movement and everybody's interest in better quality food, more sustainable food, and everything, and cider obviously is so well placed to take advantage of that. It's exciting. And actually the acid driven thing is kind of I'm seeing it a lot in the UK as well. I mean
you literally mentioned this in an episode, what, like 3 episodes ago. You were saying that acid is like one of the key ways that you can market the stuff, or one of the things people get excited about.
But I mean 100% what Albert's saying is true. It's not just in terms of, you know, people are paying more attention to Eastern Counties producers than they maybe were a few years ago. Like even like definitely larger numbers, I think, of my own drinking of ciders from the 3 counties and you know, the West Country are putting more or higher components of acid into their ciders than they were. I mean, when I did that tasting at the international competition at the museum, and I was judging the medium category, I was sitting with Sam from Wilding Cider, and we were saying, you know what, the average profile is definitely starting to tack more acidic than it was previously, which, you know, is interesting. But I hope that it doesn't completely push tannins out of the door, because
we want some nice snarly grippy tannins.
There's a nice middle ground.
Yeah. Robust, so, that's the word, right? Is that
robust is always a good word. When you've got a challenging drink, you say, don't worry, it's just quite robust.
It's interesting. I was just saying, it's interesting what you're saying, Michelle, about American varietals. I mean, I know what little I know of American apples comes from either mass media, some very, very small contact with via Adam with American Cider, or a visit to Tennessee in the distant past, where we had some, you know, the soft cider, and they were growing apples, and that was about it.
Yeah.
And I wasn't really aware of there being all that many actually American apples that are particularly well suited to cider. In my head, it was largely, you know, mass-produced kind of eating apples and cookers and that kind of thing. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Can I just jump in and just give my perspective on that and then see how it differs with Michelle's answer? Because I think that to, you know, maybe go back 10, maybe 15 years, and there was kind of, it seems to be more of an obsession with trying to grow English varieties, and everybody planning Ellis Bitter and Yarlington Mill, which wasn't even true Yarlington, and the whole stuff with Fox Up and Geneva Tremlets, and this whole interest in not looking at American fruit. But actually, if you go back way back when, Michelle already mentioned Newtown Pippin, a variety that was celebrated hundreds of years ago. And I felt for a long time that the American market is clearly succeeding when the producers start to pay attention to the American fruit. And I think it's the same for Eastern Counties producers in England. Like, they don't have to be like, oh, boo-hoo, we don't have proper cider apples. We've only got all these delicious John of Golds and all these delicious Discovery apples. Oh, they make such a nice cider, but it's not traditional apple. People are starting to embrace what's local to their region. And then that becomes sellable because it's a story. And it still tastes great. It's just because it's not a traditional cider apple. And I think that it seems all the way across the US, people are realizing that the local apples are there. And, you know, the US has probably got more varieties of apples than Britain does just because of the sheer scale of the place.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, I think a big part of it too is that people are starting to realize how challenging some of these apples from overseas are. Like, people are always talking about how hard it is to grow Kingston Black, and I pulled those out. I couldn't handle it anymore. But yeah, I mean, when CiderCon was in Richmond, Virginia, our keynote speaker was Diane Flint. I don't know if you guys have had Diane Flint on the show, but you should. She's amazing, and she just came out with a book. And she's a real, you know, advocate and champion for Southern apple varieties, which definitely, you know, people are always like, what? You can grow apples in the South? There's cider in the South? And like, actually, there's a really robust history of cider in the South. And there are some amazing apple varieties that are, you know, have been developed in that region. And they're all dual purpose apples, right? So I think, like, you know, when I first started this job, I'd be like, hey, there's eaters and spitters. And I would like divide the world into this binary thing of like eaters and spitters. And then at some point we quickly realized, like, well, wait a minute, cider is not binary. Like, what? It's not eaters and spitters.
I love the term spitters. That's so yeah, good.
It is a fun term.
So
it is.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there are, like you said, like John of Gold. I've had single varietal John of Golds that are great. Like, they're just like, and you know, some of these apples just have such a rich history. And sometimes it's like a single tree, right? Like, I know cideries that are making like a Solera over a couple years from a single tree because they can't even get enough fruit off of it to do a single vintage. So they're like blending 3 years worth together. Like, it's, you know, so I think that, you know, and also what's also happening in the US, and we're going to talk a little bit about CiderCon, and I'm not sure how much it happens in the UK. My ignorance about the UK, I've never been, is definitely going to show today. But, you know, there's a lot of apple variety development based off of wild seedlings. Like, that's happening a lot with American cider makers. So, you know, every now and then I'll be like, what apple is this? And they'll be like, oh, it's A62-B. I'm like, huh, what? You know? gotcha. So it's
a name to really conjure with.
And I think some of that is people are probably looking for tannins, but I don't think it's just tannins. They want the sugars and the acid too. So I don't know. I think we are in the second wave of the modern American cider revolution, and that it is being driven largely by two things: a broad understanding of the diversity and nuances of the cider category as a category and not just a beverage, and exploration and acceptance of American apples. So I think those two things are working really well for the category right now. Yeah, Arkansas Black is like a great southern apple. Newtown Pippin, Grav. I mean, and some of these I claim as American apples, and they're not like developed. Like Gravenstein was not developed in America, but it's been here a long time. So, Arley Red, you know, that's where all our red flesh are coming from. Arley Red is a pretty common red flesh apple, especially on the West Coast.
I got an I was emailing Eleanor at Eden Ciders recently for a kind of side project thing I'm doing about American apple varieties, and it was amazing. You know, within like I don't know, it was an astonishingly small amount of time. It was less than 5 minutes. I got an email back being like, "Thanks, you know, lovely to hear from you. Here are what I'd say are like the 8 or 9, you know, most prolific American apple varieties."
Inside.
You know, being incredible. But that's Eleanor, isn't it? Funnily, something that you said kind of links in a really tangential way back to CiderCon, just because you were mentioning single tree stuff and the. Yeah. The Perry, one of the Perrys that Albert that will be in the talk that Albert and I are part of at CiderCon is a single tree from Barry Masterson at Kirtle Writer, which always blows my mind. I mean, it's what other drink could you say here's something that's come from just one tree?
Exactly.
The Helden.
Yes, yeah, the Helden.
Oh yeah, the Helden tree. Yeah.
Give it a plug. sorry, Albert, that's back to you. But I think you had some questions about.
I was just going to say that the abundance of wild seedling fruit in the US is one of my main envies because all of our varieties in Britain that we use for cider pretty much were seedlings from the 1800s or earlier that were discovered and propagated. And they're definitely, you know, the mainstream varieties like Dabinet. That's the main source of them, and the new varieties that have been bred here were primarily bred for mass production, and so they don't necessarily have the same depth of flavor as we get from these historic varieties. But because Britain is so dense, we don't have the wild trees and the number of people looking at wild fruit as well that you've got in the States. So I've said possibly to Adam before or to someone else that, you know, I'm anticipating that in 35 years time, the varieties being used for cider in the US, we may not know about them right now, but they will be there and they will be really exciting. And I also think that the acid driven market trend aside, there's no reason why apples with the flavor of Dabinet or Yarnington Mill in England can't be matched by different native varieties in the US that are adapted to the US soils and climate and everything else and the growing season. So I think it's really exciting that more people in the States are looking at wild apples and discovering something that's been waiting for them for 10 years, for 15 years, whatever, you know, in the forest. It's really amazing.
I mean, there are entire cider companies that only use foraged apples, several of them. Like,
it's so cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like a subcategory, honestly. Like, someone was saying to me the other day, is foraged cider a style? And I was like, well, I don't know if it's a style, but it's definitely a thing. Yeah.
I had an Eves Perry, and it had on the label that the maker who was Matt Moser Miller, who I know, I originally met at Ross and Wye, funnily enough, but it said that he had walked 150 miles in the process of foraging the pears that went into this Perry, which I thought was a really cool detail.
Wow.
I mean, I guess actually talking of wildings, I guess it's slightly more common in the UK to be like, we don't know what this Perry pear tree is. You know, I seem to see that more than apples, but again, like, it's nothing like the scale of wilding fruit in America. I mean, I guess another thing that makes it, you know, particularly useful that there's all these wild trees that are being harvested, because obviously we're having in the UK at the moment a huge problem with fire blight. And our pear varieties, as Albert said on the show before, are just, you know, for the most part not resistant to it, because they're really old varieties. They're certainly older than we've had the blight in the UK. But I mean, you've got to think that if there are going to be these kind of resistant varieties, a lot of those are going to have to, you know, will inevitably come from America, because they're varieties that have survived despite being in, you know, places like the northeastern states where, you know, I know there's so much fire blight and where it kind of came from originally.
So I guess, you know, the U.S. is definitely still struggling with fire blight, and I think a lot of the culinary breeding programs are focused on fire blight resistant development. So hopefully some good dual purpose apples will sneak their way. But I've been to a culinary apple conference, and they make fun of dual purpose apples sometimes. So it's just not on their radar. But I've had Eleanor's Honey Crisp Ice Cider, and it is delicious. So, you know, I always say don't count out the culinary apples. And I actually have pressured a few cider makers to make Honeycrisp single varietals, because it's like, how do you train the American consumer to start thinking about cider in terms of apples? You guys, people think that apple names are hops sometimes. They have no clue. Like Kingston Black, they're like, oh, is that a hop? Is this a hopped cider? Like, it has to say Kingston Black apple, or they just don't draw the connection. So if we're using apples that people are familiar with, like Honeycrisp, and they'll be like, oh, a cider can be made out of a specific apple and that can impact the flavor. So I like training wheels. We need some consumer training wheels here.
Well, it's funny. In a kind of directly riffing off that. So I'm in one of the hobby communities I'm part of. There's a lot of people in it who are like super into their beer, and a lot of them are in the US. And that, you know, every so often they've now quarantined it on the Discord. So there's one channel where everybody is allowed to talk about food and beer. So it doesn't go into the rest of the channels. And what's interesting is that they're all like, loads of them are like mega wild knowledgeable about beer, and some of them like cider. But again, that the idea of it being like, oh, this is a single variety seems to be completely alien. And I was just wondering, like, I guess that's kind of riffing into a question about like the peculiar difficulties of like the American palate. What are the things that you run into that cause you problems with like trying to educate about cider in the US that you feel like is unique to the US rather than a kind of more general cider issue? I don't know, or the general American palate, as you referenced earlier. If generalizations can be made about so huge a place.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have a lot of exposure to like UK cider consumers. So my perspective on like the UK cider industry is driven by the cider industry. So I haven't had, you know, conversations with cider consumers. But in the US, I think the biggest issue is that people want to say they like dry cider, just like they want to say they like the hoppiest beer available, right? It's almost like, I mean, I don't think it's just the case. It might be part of like diet culture. I don't know. But like, I like dry cider. I mean, with beer, it's certainly like, I like hoppy beers is certainly almost like a masculine thing, right? Yeah. But like with cider, it's like, I like dry cider. And then you do a flight for them and they go for the semi-sweet.
I've written an article about this that went out just on Wednesday. The phenomenon of people talking dry and drinking sweet is enormous. And I think there is there's maybe almost a slight stigma that comes with sweet. You know, it almost like people are like, oh, you know, that's not the proper one. That's not the grown up one. And then obviously like it becomes more complicated when, you know, there's the idea that there's sweet cider and then there's sweet cider, you know, there's pack sweetened and all this sort of stuff versus something that's, you know, cold rack keeved, whatever it we'll go down a whole different thread. But that exact phenomenon is very, very present in the UK, and it and some makers find it intensely frustrating. Because it just, you know, you don't know how to, you know, people say, well, I want a dry cider, and then they have a dry cider and they're like, oh, what's going on with this?
I mean, we were doing a cider consumer education thing at Cider Summit, and we had a table with the Northwest Cider Association where we were trying to train people on tannins. So we had a low tannin cider and a high tannin cider, and I watched people like spit out the high tannin cider. Right. Like they're just, so I think just like any product, if you are trying to market it to everyone, you're not going to succeed. So there are people out there who like high tannin ciders, how do we find them? I don't know. What do they all have in common? Maybe they're all like snowboarders or something. I don't know. I don't know what it is, but somehow we have to find the folks that like hide tannin ciders and market it to them. Otherwise we just got to like baby steps. Like I think the one that I saw people spit out was actually a single varietal cabinet, maybe that they were just like, ew, no.
Sacrilege.
It was so good. It was so good. Yeah.
I had a customer in my pub on Saturday, Michelle, who tried a single variety Dabinet and then complained to me that they were, and I quote, exceedingly disappointed because, and again, I quote, it tastes like a cider apple. And I'm like, well, you know, I'm sorry. Next time I'll lace it with sugar and you'll be fine.
Yeah. Lace it with sugar, get some acetic in there and...
Yeah, get it the acetic in there. Oh gosh. I mean, the other problem is trying to get retailers to sell 750s. Do retailers sell 750s in the UK?
So the 750 market is an interesting one. It's one that didn't exist in a large scale 5 years ago and now definitely does. But it's also the one that everyone is being drawn to. And so I feel there's saturation point. Producers are putting out more and more releases. And not selling out of old ones, or at least that's what I'm doing. So it's a harder and harder market. But it's definitely, you know, something it's still growing. It's just the growth, because of COVID and home delivery, the growth was astronomical.
Yeah.
And now it's just kind of tickling up a little bit as part of the wider trend towards proper cider, I think. But actually, on that topic, I wanted to ask you, before we jumped into CiderCon, I think... when you were talking to Rhea, you said that your membership, you're like, most of our members are small producers. But then you said, I think the figure you gave was 50,000 gallons as your line for what's small or not, which to all of the English producers who just heard me say that are like, what?
Okay.
You may be aware of, you may not. In the UK, there's been this historical duty exemption where if you made 7,000 liters of cider, you didn't get taxed on it. Selling it commercially. But if you made 7,001, you sold the whole lot. Now, that's just been overhauled in August, but essentially, so the Free County Cider Imperial Association that I'm the vice chair of, we probably have 130 members, and I would say 115 of them are producing 7,000 liters or less. So we're tiny. But what is it like in the US? What is the perspective of most people on what is small?
So I think the craft beer market influences the US perspective of what is small, because I think some of our largest cideries would be classified as microbreweries, based on beer definition. So, you know, I would say like, what is small? Well, it's small versus nano, right? Like, we have a lot of members making less than 5,000 gallons a year, a lot. And it's basically like an inverse relationship to how many members we have on how many gallons someone is making. And that's due to numbers. Like, there's more of them, right? There are more cideries making less than 5,000 gallons a year. What is, you're going to ask me to draw a line in the sand, and I don't know if I'm, I would say, I would say if someone's making less than 100,000 gallons a year, I would consider them small. If they're making more than 100,000 gallons a year, I could consider them medium size and probably up to about like 750,000 gallons. And then after that, you know, we're looking at pretty big, but there's not that many making at that size. There's a few, and a few making a couple million gallons a year, but most of them are teeny tiny.
I've just Googled how many liters are in a US gallon.
Frantically Googling gallons to liters.
Sorry.
Yeah, that is the entire aspirational cider making community of the UK is like, I think maybe I mean, how much does Tom make? About 200,000, maybe. So he might have just crept into
he's nowhere near that.
Oh, is he not? Oh, for some reason, no. I had that right. So, all right. Well, then, yeah. everyone's small.
I mean, I think, it just depends on your channels, right? Like, if you decide you're going to start doing retail, you have to get bigger.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're not going to have the supply. So if people are doing a diverse operation, they need to be somewhere around 100,000 or they're going to struggle to fulfill all those different channels.
Yeah, so I think that the suggestion of size is a little bit dramatic. I think what's really interesting for us is that there, I think maybe more American cider makers get started with the commercial mindset from the start. It can't just be a hobby that grows out of control, which is what happens to a lot of UK producers, because you can make 500 liters and you don't get taxed, so you start selling it, and suddenly next year you've made 3,000, and then suddenly you have a, not full time, but you have a business on your hands that takes up a lot of your time. Whereas I think in the US you don't have that kind of experience so much. People who decide they're going to start selling cider are like, right, I'm going to start selling cider, I need to make a serious amount. Is that fair?
I think that was the case. I think that was the case back in the like 2010s when cider was having the first wave of the American modern cider revolution. And we were, you know, when I took this job, cider was the fastest growing segment of the beverage industry. And that caught a lot of entrepreneurs' eyes, right? Like an entrepreneur is like, whoa, well, I need to get into the cider biz. So I definitely think there was that there are people that fell in love with cider as sort of a consequence of joining the industry that maybe didn't come to it. But we are really close partners with the Cider Institute of North America. And their executive director, Bridget, tells me that overwhelmingly the people that are signing up for their cider making education courses have interests in having an orchard, and that it's like a orchard based passion for them. And we do see a lot of new cider folks, but I think the newest source for new cider folks right now is wine. There's a lot of people playing with apples, and part of that is because of smoke taint and freezes.
Smoke,
and...
did you say smoke taint?
Yeah, from wildfires.
A real problem.
Oh, wow.
They have that in Australia as well. And I mean, California must be awful for it.
So, I mean, the natural wine set, like the natural wine market, is basically kind of allowing people to do things like cider and grape co-ferments, which weren't super popular not too long ago and now are increasingly popular. Thanks to the open mind of the natural wine consumer. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting to see how that sort of plays out for American cider makers.
It's literally, it goes back to what I was saying about the trends being the same, because this afternoon I had a winemaker come up from Sussex to collect a load of apples off me that they're going to go back and go ferment. It's happening. It's happening in the UK as well. People being really interested in merging them together.
Yeah.
So you started being involved at the ACA nearly 8 years ago. What was, CiderCon had been going five years by that point, right? What's the big difference between then and now with CiderCon?
Yeah. Well, it's a lot more organized because we have staff. God bless the like people who were involved, just because of their passion for it. But a lot of it actually hasn't changed, it's evolved. But the things that make CiderCon special, the networking, the international participation, the sensory component, not a lot of beverage conferences in the U.S. have a sensory component. I know that's more common abroad, but in the U.S. it's not super common. And we make sure that that's a part of CiderCon. I think the biggest change is that we're bringing in people from outside of the cider industry to speak at CiderCon. So for a while, it was just sort of the cider community talking amongst ourselves. And then we realized, okay, we're talking in circles. We need some outside perspective if we're going to help this thing grow. So now we try to bring in people from other segments that are, whether it's the consumer packaged goods or beer or wine or spirits or whatever, something relevant to kind of get the outside perspective. Because otherwise we just keep looking at cider and being like, why isn't cider growing the way we think it should? And it's like, well, that's because we're only talking amongst ourselves. So that's been a big thing. But it's the structure of it hasn't fundamentally changed all that much. We still have tours early in the week. Now we have a certified pomelier exam every year, which we didn't have back then. It's interesting. Like it gets more and more professional and more, diverse, and more international every year. So it's kind of like almost like a positive reinforcing evolution loop. Like CiderCon is growing because of CiderCon. It's really cool. It's just like, keeps getting bigger and better with time.
Really awesome. I've suddenly realized that for our 12 international listeners, we haven't actually explained what CiderCon is. So could you tell us a little bit of the history of CiderCon and what it is, and what is particular and special about this year's edition or next year's edition?
I will. And I just realized what's the biggest difference between now and 2016, and that's the trade show. So the trade show is cider specific. And I think in like, in 2016 was the last time it was in Oregon. CiderCon was in Oregon. There were only like 40 vendors, and now we have over 100, and they come from all over the world. So CiderCon is I mean, you guys correct me, but I'm pretty sure it's the world's largest professional cider conference. I
mean, it must be. Yeah. It must be.
I say that a lot, and I hope it's true. So, yeah. And it is cider tours. So we explore cideries in the area. It rotates locations from West Coast Chicago, East Coast Chicago, West Coast Chicago, East Coast Chicago. And then we have like what we call, master classes, where we're doing like in-depth education for several hours. And the feature of those changes every year. This year, Sina's doing a new cider maker workshop. And then the agency that regulates cider in the U.S. is doing a workshop as well. And then we have Cider Share. Cider Share is really special. Cider Share is our welcome reception. I also say it's the world's largest cider share. I'm pretty sure that's accurate as well. And we have anywhere from, depending on the year, 50 to 80 cideries from all around the world sampling their cider for all the attendees. We have lots of food and there's music, and it's a really special welcome reception. People are just smiling. They're like, I can't believe there's all this different cider and I get to taste it. So that's Wednesday night. And then Thursday and Friday, we have our trade show and our workshops. So the trade show, it's unique because it's cider specific. Our vendors love it. They come back every year. They race to come back every year. I think part of it is because our attendees are just really nice, because we're the cider industry. We're like the Canadians of beverage world. But also because the cider industry is growing, and it has been sustainably slowly growing for some time. So they see business at CiderCon. But we also make it fun. Like, we have games, and this year we're having a tattoo bus on the cider floor. We're having a pinball tournament. We're having all kinds of fun things on the trade show floor. So we try to make it, not corporate and stuffy, but like fun and engaging. And then we've got 40 workshops is typically where we land, around 40 different workshops. And the workshops span every aspect of running a successful cidery, from growing apples to marketing and selling to business practices. We try to touch on every piece. So really, like, I think, what I spoke with Rhea a little bit, but I think it deserves to be mentioned again, is that we work really hard to make sure that there is content relevant to people who have been making cider for a long, 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 long time, and people who have never made cider before but want to open a cidery. So we try really hard to make sure that there are workshops relevant to everybody, whether they're 2 million gallons a year or 2,000 gallons a year. We've got workshops that will help them. And it's just a really happy, inspiring time. Everyone leaves CiderCon jazzed.
Pretty cool. I'm super excited to be going to my first one. I think you may not realize, but CiderCon is the large inspiration that for James and Susanna Forbes from Little Pomona for them to come back in 2019 and to start the UK equivalent. So we call it GraphCon because you already have taken the good name. So we have the least cidery conference name, but we're setting to do our fourth one next year in April. And when we start planning the program, I literally look at the CiderCon program and I'm like, what do I like out of this would work in the UK? And that's my starting point. So
I love that. I'm so glad that it's been a source of inspiration. I love the cross Atlantic collaboration. It's great.
Yeah. We got my kind of first practical taste of CiderCon, I guess, was in lockdown year when it went online, and I mean that was incredible. I remember I can't imagine the amount of effort it must have taken to put all of that to make it all digital, but that, you know, just attending some of the classes there, and this was before I did, because I missed the 2019 CraftCon, so it was my first time kind of doing an event where you could go to all these different seminars, you know, even digitally, and it was just so mind broadening to, as you say, to listen to this range of speakers that you get and talk on talks on such a diverse range of topics. I mean, I think there was one I went to. It was co-fermentations, and then there were all the practical and technical conferences, and then and different speakers from. I mean, obviously, there's such a large pool to draw from within just American cider, but it was really noticeable, even to me, who knows nothing about American cider, that they had kind of been drawn from a much broader pool. So yeah, it's been incredibly inspiring to kind of watch from afar, and I'm so excited to come over to Oregon and finally see it. So tell us about a few of the talks and tastings that are on this year.
Yeah, so we do have a that co-fermentation panel that we did in 2021 was great, but it was virtual, so there was no tasting component. So we do have two co-fermentation panels happening right now. Co-fermentation is a trend in the U.S. at the moment, so we've got one focused on wine and beer, and then we're trying to kind of we're taking almost a single varietal approach to co-fermentation. We're focusing on stone fruit co-fermentation. That's Dan Pucci's panel, so that'll be interesting. I'm a huge fan of Jerkum, so that kind of I'm excited to see kind of explore like single varietal or not single varietal. Well, yeah, actually, it'll be single varietal Jerkum versus a co-ferment apple plum. That should be interesting. And then we've got our friends from Norway and Sweden coming to talk about kind of their cider revolution that's happening. And then let's see, what are some of the other kind of harvest-driven talks that we have? Ancestral Method. And I believe you've met Kimberly from Metal House. We just confirmed her from the Hudson Valley. Did you meet her when you were in New York? Adam?
No, I didn't.
Oh, okay. We are in for a treat then. I hope that's not I don't think it's the same time as the Perry talk. I really like the cider that Kimberly's making at Metal House. We just confirmed that she's coming and being a part of that panel, so I'm thrilled about that. So those are some of the kind of the like, you know, the harvest driven kind of the more ingredient focused talks. And then we've got some great talks on production, including like flaw correction. Then we have some really great business ones, including one that is hitting, I don't know if it's hitting UK producers, I'd be interested, but it's hitting Americans pretty hard right now, and that's burnout. So we've got a section on burnout They did a survey for the beer industry, and it was like 99% of the beer industry was burnt out.
Jesus.
And so we're trying to learn more about what that, you know, is it the same for cider? Are we in danger of like the whole industry burning out here soon? It does seem like some of the cideries that are closing is maybe just due to burnout. So, you know, that's something that we're really interested in. And then we do, you know, I won't plug the data ones too much, but it might be, I mean, I always like learning about other segments, so it might be interesting. Like if there was a data talk on UK, you bet I would be there to learn more about it. But we do have some data-driven talks. We've got some great orcharding talks. We've got Michael Biltonen coming to talk more about sustainable orcharding practices, biodynamic orcharding practices. We're gonna have a couple sessions on, and then I mentioned the foraging one as well. So that's kind of a hodgepodge. There's a lot. Like I said, there's 40. So, but
40 disparate talks on around cider is just incredible, just epic. And you touched earlier on like the tours and stuff that go on beforehand. So firstly, two-parter. Firstly, I'd like to ask that. And secondly, I wanted to visit Oregon and Portland for years now. So I'm extra excited that I'm coming to this side of Con because it's being held in somewhere that I've wanted to go. So, you know, in terms of like cider stuff generally in Portland and Oregon particularly, you know, what should I kind of make sure that I get over and have a look at, but also what are the things that are going on earlier on in the week?
Yeah. Okay. Let me talk about the tours really fast, and then I'll talk about everything else that's happening. So, we have two overnight tours because we wanted to include the industry in Washington, which is just across the river. So one is going to the Olympic Peninsula, and that's going to hit Eagle Mount, Finn River, Alpenfire. And then the other tour is doing the Seattle market. And the thing that's really interesting about the Seattle market is that it's hitting, I think, four cideries, and they're all different sizes and they all have different business models, but they're all in Seattle. So it's pretty interesting. You'll be able to see like, it'll be a very representative slice of like the American cider market. And you know, even these urban, like Yonder Cider is one of the cideries, and it has an urban tasting room, but they're growing specialty and apples and sourcing specialty apples from throughout the Northwest. So I don't know. You can't go wrong with either of those. Like Seattle's a beautiful, amazing city, and the Olympic Peninsula is definitely one of the most beautiful places on earth. And some of those cideries, you know, Finn River and Alpenfire are just stunningly gorgeous. Places to visit. So those are two of the overnight tours. You'd have to get there pretty early on Monday. You'd have to get there Sunday, I think, to participate in those. But it's definitely worth it if you want to see a different part of the Northwest that you can't see during CiderCon. And we have one going out to the Columbia River Gorge. I lived in the Columbia River Gorge for a while. It is paradise. It is, you know, it's a windsurfing area, so it's like a really windy area, and it has a really unique growing climate, and like most of the U.S.'s winter pears were grown there at some point. So it's a pear and apple growing region. It's also a wine region. They have like an AVA and everything, so there's like an interesting cider cider country. Like it's a part of cider country in the Columbia River Gorge. So that one's going to be really fun. And then we've got a Portland quirky culinary adventure. This is for folks that just really want to explore more techniques for cider and food pairing. It's being led by the ACA's education operation manager, Jenny Dorsey, and she is like just a genius with pairing. She does this bite. She did it at CiderCon last year. It's like chocolate and pimento cheese or something really weird, and you're like, what, this sounds terrible, and then you taste it and you pair it with cider and you're like, well, that was like literally the perfect bite and sip. I don't know how she comes up with this stuff. So that one's going to be really fun. It'll be low key. It'll be just around Portland. And then the Willamette Valley region is going to what is, you know, Willamette Valley is like one of the most respected wine regions in the world, and there's some amazing cider being made there too. So that's a great one to check out. So those are kind of all the tours happening on Monday and Tuesday. Happening on Tuesday, except for the overnights. Yeah,
that last one sounds amazing, because I mean, yeah, most of my geography of the area is just gleaned from working in the wine industry for years, and a large part of why before I kind of got really, really into cider, a large part of the reason I wanted to visit Oregon was like the wine, because we don't see too much of it over here in the UK. That's really cool.
I think we've covered CiderCon pretty well, and I'm conscious of time, but there's kind of two things I wanted to talk about more generally with the ACA. One of them, the simpler one, is I've seen on your website you just had National Cider Month in the US in October. And how long has that been going? Did the ACA kind of start promoting that? Is it a big thing? How do you get the most out of it?
Yeah, so it's not an ACA initiative. It's a grassroots initiative that the ACA doesn't really have anything to do with, other than like it's exciting to see cideries coming together. It was totally spearheaded by Schilling Cider House, which is one of the larger cideries in the US. And so I think they've been promoting it like as part of their company for a couple of years, but this year they really opened it up to other folks. And I'm not sure where it's going to go, but there was definitely a boost in some of the channels where National Cider Month was it was really targeting retail, I think, this year. And, you know, my hope is that it'll grow beyond that, and that it'll become, a force for increased direct-to-consumer sales as well. But, National Cider Month. You guys have the issue where people only drink cider in the summer. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, so we have the opposite issue. People only drink cider in the fall.
I heard that's amazing. Because you have this phenomenon of going to the farm to get freshly pressed apple juice, right?
Yes. You guys have all seen the SNL apple picking skit, I hope. If you haven't, Google it after this. It's a very accurate representation.
The only context I really have for that Simpsons episode with Ned Flanders saying if it's brown, you're in Cider Town or whatever it is.
Yes. Yes. I say that quote all the time. Yeah. And that's actually... The other thing that you guys are talking about that's like, specific to the US is the word cider. Like we call fresh pressed juice cider. I wish that they would just call it soft cider. I mean, I've seen in some of the historical literature, it was referred to as soft cider at some point, and then at some point the soft got dropped. And yeah, that's really challenging. One time I was meeting with a congressional staffer, and he was going on and on and on about how much he loves wine sap cider, and it was like a big part of it. And then like 20 minutes into our conversation, he goes, "Oh, are you just talking about hard cider?" I mean, that's like,
I mean, I did have that when I alluded earlier to an ancient visit to Tennessee. I went as part of a university trip, and we were going around all these farms, and there was a bit where, me as a 19-year-old obviously wasn't allowed to be drinking in the US, but was in the UK. And we went to this farm. There were all these things advertised as cider, and all these like I saw all these like kids buying it, and I was like, "What the fuck is that? Like? Is this some kind of like? Is this like very very like 1% beer that they have in Russia, where it's like doesn't strictly speaking count as alcohol, and so you can buy it or something like that?" I was like, "Are they all these kids just getting lathered on cider?" And then it was like, "Oh no, it's like cloudy apple juice." Oh, right, okay, that was weird to me, but it made sense there. But yeah, I imagine, does that cause you a lot of problems then?
We don't have to go off on it, but I see both.
Please do.
I see both sides, right? Like, at first I was like, all right, folks, like get over it. Just call it hard cider. Like, come on. And then Nielsen, like the consumer data folks, they put up a slide and it was like hard tea, hard soda, hard coffee, hard cider. And I was like, oh no, the hard has got to go. One of these things is not like the other.
Yeah.
But then now I, like we just did our we just put out a publication. It's the first time we've done this. It's a magazine that we're calling the Cider State of the Industry. Ooh. And I made sure it said hard cider on the front because I really wanted to make sure people knew what we were talking about. And yeah. So it's, yeah, I'm getting a little less weird about using it. I'm actually starting to use it a little more, but maybe I'll swing back the other way at some point. But yeah, it's that one. That's a tricky thing in the US.
Good, you got both on the cover. I mean, that is yeah. That is very difficult. I mean, yeah, anything like I mean, hard cider is it's I can hear that it's like not the nicest term, but
yeah
I mean, as you say,
sort of redolent of brown paper bags.
I've gone off on some sort of tangent. Albert, what was your question? Can you
No, please, Michelle, please don't worry. This is the brand of this podcast is going off on tangent. Good. So please, tangent away.
I am fascinated, you know, like because so you know, you're the CEO of the American Cider Association. And in the UK, we have the National Association of Cider Makers, founded more than 100 years ago by Bulmers and a few other producers. And now the kind of core voting members are pretty much international breweries with a few UK cider makers on there as well. Like Sanford Orchards, I think, is a member. Nightingale, where I'm assuming they still are, and so on. And they're the ones that really go in and speak to government. And this thing about hard cider or not, and the staffer being the example, like it's the same. The government doesn't understand how I make cider. They have no comprehension of it at all. They just recently overhauled the tax system for how we pay the tax. And it literally is clearly produced by someone that has no conception of what real life cider production is like. And the NACM, I don't think they're a malicious body at all. That's not at all what I'm about saying. But fundamentally, their core members are year-round producers, right? Compared to, say, harvest-driven producers. So there's no one really in government that's advocating for seasonal producers. On the other hand, the NACM care about small makers. And they've been instrumental of getting, in the UK, we've just had small producers relief opened up, which is going to help people hopefully grow from 7,000 litres and above it, because it used to be a pretty hard ceiling, but now that's changed. But anyway, I think that they just don't get it. But how is it for you, and maybe, and hopefully, you don't feel that there's much of an obstacle in terms of the stuff that the ACA is saying to in lobbying and not, but you've obviously got members that are 2 million gallons making it year round, maybe from concentrate or not, and then the small ones that are harvest driven that still want you to be there and supporting them.
Yeah. You know, I think what's interesting is that kind of the earlier where they had, I think what's interesting is that the needs are actually strikingly similar between the two groups. It used to be that you reached a certain point and your taxes went way up and you lost any of the advantages that you had as a small producer. Like you hit a certain benchmark and all those advantages went away like that. And the ACA was part of a group, beer, wine, spirits, all working together to try and support small producers. And that's kind of why my definition of small is maybe a little big, is because I was advocating for the small producer tax credit. And when that happened, it removed a barrier to growth. And so that was really important for the medium-sized producers. And then the other thing that the ACA was able to fix, you know, is being able to put cider over 7% alcohol by volume in a 12-ounce can. Mm-hmm. And that helped both the big folks who are maybe capitalizing and putting it in a 12-ounce can, and also the harvest-driven folks who are just fermenting to where cider naturally ferments, and it's often over 7% ABV. So now we're working on 16-ounce and 19.2-ounce cans. And then there are, you know, some weird, really weird carbonation taxes on the books that go back to the 1920s when the U.S. was like, let's get even with France. Let's tax champagne. Oh, wait, maybe there are unintended consequences for our own sparkling wine producers, but we're not going to worry about that. So that one's turning out to be a bigger lift than I had anticipated. But right now, the thing that everyone, I think the UK is a really good example of, like, why we should be worried about this. But man, neo-prohibitionism. How about
that? I literally was just about to bring that back up.
Yeah. So, you know, and it's all in nuance, right? Like, there's no gray area. It's like all or nothing. And we know that that's not reality. Reality is not black and white. Reality is in the gray area. So to try and demonize something that's been enjoyed for thousands of years, as part of, you know, what it means, to sit around a table and celebrate is just, I don't know. It's fascinating to me. So, everyone's facing kind of similar issues. I think the issues that differentiate the two groups have to do with, like, more like business practices than it does with lobbying. So, like, working with distributors or getting distributors to understand what cider is. But again, that's like just a size thing. Like, a small cidery is going to struggle to partner with a distributor just because they're small and they don't have the staff. And like in the US, the distributor is looking more and more to producers to provide like some of the services in the sales. Whereas maybe back in the day, the distributor would work really hard to sell your product for you. I think there are still some distributors out there, but they're streamlining too. So there's a lot of streamlining happening that I think is impacting cideries. But yeah, it's interesting. I think there's a lot in common, actually. Like, and I think that's what part of the reason the American Cider Association as a big tent organization continues to grow is because the teeny tiny cideries and the really big cideries actually do have a lot of the same barriers.
Yeah, I think that's totally fair to say. I think, you know, it's, my opinion is always that the rising tide lifts all boats, which actually I think you might have said the same thing to Rhea, or she might have said the same thing to you in that episode. But and that's what's common in the UK as well. You know, the funniest thing is Weston's produced an annual cider report where they call Henry Weston's vintage the premium crafted cider. That's part of the sector. But Henry Weston's vintage is doing well because we're doing well. And actually, we're doing well because Henry Weston's vintage is doing well, even though it's a product that is so removed from what I'm producing. But it does start in the same place. Okay. So last thing I'd love to talk about is the Cider is for Everyone scholarship that you guys have got going. I mean, you mentioned the Pommelier scheme. The great thing about it is it is bringing people into cider. And then Cider's for Everyone, you guys are going an extra step further. You can tell our listeners what that's all about.
Yeah, sure. So it's our goal that the cider industry is reflective of America, right? Like, we want the cider industry to represent America. And part of the reason we want to do that is because we want more people drinking cider, and the consumer base is increasingly diverse and is only going to get more diverse with time. So the Cider is for Everyone scholarship is an effort to open up the CiderCon experience to more diverse audiences. This is going to be our fourth year doing it. Last year, we had a cohort of 8. The year before that, we had a cohort of 4. And then another year, we did it in the pandemic, and it was more just our online education program than in the online CiderCon. So it's really been going, like, really hard for 2 years. And this will be the third year. And it pays for the whole experience for recipients to come and participate in CiderCon. And it goes to people in different, like, they don't have to be a cider maker. We had a couple folks in the media last year come, and that was great because they ended up writing really amazing pieces. They weren't required to, but they ended up writing really amazing pieces about CiderCon. So that was, you know, kind of a really interesting synergy. And then the other part of the scholarship is, like, they get a cohort. I was in North Carolina recently, and there were scholarship recipients hanging out with each other that actually, like, planned to meet up and hang out because they, like, made friends and they were meeting in North Carolina to go to the cider festival together. So, like, it's creating this whole community of people that are new to cider but are getting really excited about it. And it's opening. I mean, we said at CiderCon last year, like, you just stand back and look at CiderCon, and, like, it's literally diversifying before our eyes. It's a really cool thing to see. And, you know, cider education is the other piece of the scholarship. So a lot of our scholarship recipients have studied and passed and become certified pomeliers. And that's really exciting too. Because I know that's something a lot of certification programs struggle with is, you know, wanting to have diverse audiences and make sure that there are all different types of people that are getting those certifications. And it seems like the scholarship program is helping us with that, both organically and inorganically. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah, and a huge shout out to Yonder Cider for all their efforts, and Ancho Cider. Those two cideries in particular, and actually James Creek. Those three cideries have all been really involved in fostering the development of that scholarship. And last year's scholarship was almost entirely funded by Yonder. And the year before that, I think, was Ancho. So it's just been like a couple of cideries have just really decided that they're going to put a lot of effort into this. And its impact has been huge.
Mm. Mm. Well, then I'm really glad you got
that shout out. Redfield Cider Bar, too. I keep giving them all shout outs, but Redfield Cider Bar. If anybody's ever in California, make sure you check them out. They're great.
I've seen them online, and you know, the cider bar and the shop, and yeah, I just wish I had that around the corner from
yeah.
Well, okay, incredible. So let me.
You asked a question about what to check out when you're in Portland. Let's make sure we don't forget that. So, speaking of cider bars, there are a couple of cider bars in Portland. One is called The Place, and it is, you know, kind of got that Redfield vibe to it. It's got a lot of 750s. It's got a lot of international ciders. It's a great place. So The Place is a great place. And then there's another place called Cider Bite, which is downtown. And so those are kind of the two like cider bars, but a lot of the bottle shops in Portland will carry cider. Some of them have pretty great cider selection, actually. This place called John's Marketplace, which is just down the road from The Place, carries a lot of UK ciders, including Little Pomona and Oliver's, but a lot of US ciders as well. They have a huge cider section. So John's and The Place are definitely worth checking out. And then it's going to be Oregon Cider Week. So we're working with Northwest Cider Association to make sure there are events happening throughout the week. It just sort of happens naturally around CiderCon. So it'll be Oregon Cider Week, and there will be all sorts of extracurricular cider activities available to pursue through Oregon Cider Week. So shout out to Northwest Cider Association for their support there.
Yeah. Lots to do.
Right. I haven't even talked about food, but Portland has a pretty great food scene. So anybody has any questions about where to eat, I can help.
Adam, did you know that Olivia and Mike from Redfield used to have a cider podcast? The shop opened.
If I'd sort of read that or something, then I'd forgotten. But
didn't have many episodes. There's one episode where we argued about 750s and cans. It was great.
Ooh, spicy.
It's worth going back.
We didn't really argue, but we debated. Yeah. We debated. Mike is going to be at CiderCon for sure. I don't know if Liv is going to make it, but I loved their podcast. I missed their podcast. It was very good.
Yeah, it was really good. And it had one episode where they were talking about apple varietals, and they attributed a quote to Steve Seelin, who I then emailed and asked, because I used it on one of my bottles. And you might remember, it was a Dabinet bottle that said, it just said on the label, it said, in 20 years, no one will be planning Dabinet.
I do
just
remember that.
The quote from the episode. And then I wrote beneath it, but for now they do, because this is great cider.
what was that? That was on a really good Dabinet. I can't remember which one it was, but yeah, I remember reading that.
It was just a really nice batch. But when I heard that in the episode, I loved the idea of it, and that was where that seed came from. That set me off thinking, you know, the bounty of the American wilderness is going to take off soon. Great.
Speaking at CiderCon too, so.
Yes. Yeah. I'm excited to meet him in person, actually. I'm just going to tie everything back from everything we've talked about. Say, one thing I'm looking forward to doing when I come to Portland is drinking a 8% cider in a can from Two Town Cider House. And it's made from Cosmic Crisp, which is an apple was developed
at together.
Washington State University, where I studied, actually. Mm-hmm. So, and I've never had a cider from it. So, I'm looking forward to that.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Really cool. Michelle, it's been so fantastic to have you on the podcast. We could keep
thanks
you
for so
like
much
several hours, but we shan't. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
And, thank you.
Thank you, guys. And thank you for, you know, spreading the word about CiderCon, but also, like, I really just appreciate your insights on the U.S. cider industry. It's really helpful for me to kind of hear your perspectives. And I know that our CiderCon attendees will be looking forward to hearing your perspectives at CiderCon, too. So excited to have you there.
Thank you so much.
Oh, wait. Yeah. Thank you.